You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, welcome to Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. I'm Wes Goldberg. Here with me, as always, it's David Ramil, and the Miami Heat got Westbrook in the face tonight by the Oklahoma City Thunder, 106-94, losing that game. Russell Westbrook getting a triple-double in like 25 minutes. It was ridiculous. That guy's really good.
He is. I don't know if most of our listeners were aware of that, but Westbrook seems to be doing some pretty good things over in Oklahoma City. I think he's got a chance of putting up some decent numbers this year.
I just saw something on Twitter. It was his third fastest triple-double of the season, and he did it in 25 minutes. He had it in like 2 minutes into the third quarter. It was or 6 minutes into the third quarter, sorry. And that was his the third fastest it took him to hit a triple-double this season. That's insane.
There's a lot of controversy about how he gets his numbers. People on the more conservative end of the spectrum think he's stat padding. Other people think that he's just carrying the team. But I think he just happens to be really good. I think that team is pretty deep, deceptively good. They've got some good role players there. And he just happens to be very good at everything except for defense. He's not a particularly strong defender, but he doesn't need to be when he's as dominant as he is. Just the ball in his hands. Man.
Like, he does so much on offense. Like, he had 10 assists in the first half. I mean, he is I don't think it's stat. All you got to do is watch maybe one or two Westbrook games and realize that it's not stat padding. Does he do a little bit of it? Maybe, but like with 10 assists in the first half, he's the only guy that can create shots for himself and for others. So it's he's got to do these things. The ball has to be in his hands. The ball is much more valuable in his hands than it is in anybody else's. And even the rebounding thing, people like guards shouldn't rebound to that rate. And it's arguably the Thunder's best version of offense is him grabbing a defensive rebound and taking down to the other side of the court. And I've not seen a player like him in the open court since LeBron, like prime LeBron. That's what it reminds me of.
That's a good point. And you know what's particularly scary is, I mean, I've stood next to him. He's just barely taller than I am. And to think of the things that he can do athletically puts me to shame. Like, I mean, nothing is quite as emasculating as standing next to Westbrook and then seeing him play and realizing there's no way you'll ever be able to accomplish even a fraction of what he's able to do. And
I think you're unrealistically hard on yourself.
Well, I mean, I had hopes that I'd be an MVP candidate this season, maybe in podcasting, but it hasn't worked out as far as my NBA career has turned out.
Well, not to talk about Westbrook the entire time, but I don't know if you noticed this.
It's easy to do that, though.
It is, and that's exactly what Eric Reid and Tony Fiorentino did the entire game. I did feel like there was a little bit of a recruiting pitch going on there. Like, every time Westbrook ran by the floor, maybe they said something a little extra loud. Maybe Westbrook goes back and watches the NBA TV game tape of this or something, which was the Heat's broadcast, was the one that NBA TV used. And hears them talk so glowingly about him, and he's like, these guys really like me. Maybe I'll consider Miami as a free agent, which is an insane thing to think of. But
it is.
I did feel like there's a little bit of a recruiting pitch going on. They compared him to Oscar Robertson every chance they had. Like, every chance they had.
It's not unrealistic. I mean, it's not an unrealistic comparison considering, you know,
no,
Oscar's
triple-double
campaign.
They were just, I mean, just bragging about him. I mean, it was unbelievable.
He's dynamic. And look, you can't help but admire and appreciate what he does. There are plenty of critics out there. When I covered the Thunder, I know that there were plenty of people debating whether he was a point guard or where he fit on the guard spectrum and things of that sort. Who cares? For me, it's always been about just appreciating what he can do. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't necessarily have that opinion before I watched him as closely as I had to. But having done so, I feel better for it because it was just it's incredible to watch him do all the things he does. Just the sheer athleticism, the dominance, the fact that he does carry the team as much as he does and does all these things so well, it's easy to appreciate him, in my opinion. But, you know, there was another team on the other end of the spectrum. Unfortunately, Miami was on the receiving end of another Westbrook triple-double. They just didn't have an answer for him. They didn't have an answer for much, to be honest with you. Oklahoma City Thunder really used their two big man lineup. They had Steven Adams rolling and getting Hassan Whiteside into foul trouble early on. Then Enes Kanter came off the bench and, to me, looked particularly dominant. For a guy who gets a lot of crap, you know, about his defense, I think he's just so good offensively, and he's so smooth. Having either Whiteside, Willie Reed, or anybody try to defend him, it was impossible to stop Cantor, who was on his way to, I think, 19 points on 9 of 16 shooting, finished with 8 rebounds, 5 offensive rebounds, 2 assists, 1 steal. Really good overall game for Cantor.
You mentioned rebounds. That was the difference in the game. Steven Adams had 6 offensive rebounds. And
wow.
I mean, what was the difference here? I've got it. 46 total rebounds to Miami's 32. The Thunder had 14 offensive rebounds. Miami had 9. It was insane. I mean, they ended up both having 82 field goal attempts in the game, but in the first half, right, or in the first quarter, I think the Thunder finished the first quarter with nearly twice as many possessions and shots than the Heat had, just because of all the offensive rebounds and turnovers and things. And the other thing that I wanted to talk a little bit about was Josh Richardson had a pretty good game. 22 points on 9 of 16 shooting, 5 rebounds, 3 assists, a steal, 0 turnovers. It was his best game of the season. Just 2 of 6 from 3-point range, but other than that, everything looked very good from him. I don't know if any of this was garbage time or what, but he was having a pretty effective game throughout.
I think, you know, part of it is the fact that, Miami had a weird starting lineup. Mm. They started Derek Williams at the power forward spot because Josh McRoberts sat out. They also started Rodney McGruder, as Goran Dragic was allegedly sitting out the game due to back spasms. And Oklahoma City's backcourt, in addition to Westbrook, features Anthony Morrow starting, and he's not much of a defender. A hell of a shooter, but not a very good defender. So it's easy to look at their weak defense in the backcourt and say that's why Miami had a possibility of putting up some decent numbers. Magruder finished with only 7 points, but Josh Richardson looked much more comfortable, had the ball in his hands with Dragic out, and looked for his shot, took a number of shots, at 6 3-point attempts is, I think, probably a season high for him, but he did look comfortable in the mid-range game in particular, and a good overall stat line for him. If there was one positive out of Miami's showing tonight, I think it was Richardson, and he did look good. Hopefully he'll continue that moving forward in the season.
It helped that he was being guarded by Anthony Morrow, because I think Westbrook was on Magruder for most of the time, giving him a kind of a rest on the defensive end. So just to recap a little bit of the game on a larger scale, I thought the game was pretty close in the first quarter, almost halfway through, and Oklahoma City ended up going on an 11-1 run to end the first period. And that gave them a 33-19 edge in the first quarter. And we've seen this in the past. Sometimes Miami comes back in games, but they've been kind of blowing a couple of these first quarters. They're digging themselves into a big hole here, and that's exactly what happened. And the Thunder are obviously a superior team here, but going to a 33-19 first quarter deficit is really tough, and it's really hard for an offensively challenged team like the Miami Heat to bounce back from that. So they fall to 10-21, drop to 5-11 at home. They did manage to kind of get it back to within 11 points, which was an improvement from like the 15-20 point deficit that it was for so much of the game, with a little under 5 minutes left, but then, that much too little and much too late.
Now, Dragic sitting out, I mean, without him, they are clearly the team looked dysfunctional. I think, Justice Winslow had not necessarily a strong game from him. He just finished with 7 points, 2 of 10 shooting, but he was trying to control the tempo a lot. He was pushing the ball up court. Mm-hmm. Didn't necessarily look, comfortable in that role. And that's what we had expected for him to have more of as far as his role throughout the season, but he did not look comfortable in that today. And without Dragic, as we've noted before, this team just doesn't look very fluid. They just didn't look comfortable there. You didn't have anybody who was aggressive other than really Richardson, and even his game being, most of it centered around the mid-range. He didn't necessarily, go to or attack the hoop as much as Dragic did, and that's really what you need is a guy like Dragic who can drive to the hoop and then kick it out to open shooters. Not that Miami has much along the perimeter either, but at the same time, you kind of want more of that balance. Things that we've seen in their stronger games, this was not a very good showing for Miami. And Dragic
is sitting out. Can I jump on that Winslow thing really quick?
Absolutely.
I thought that you're right. He didn't look comfortable. And we've seen this season when Dragic has been out, or maybe Waiters has been out, and Winslow's been on the floor as the sole creator. And he doesn't look good as the primary guy. He does He does look good as a secondary or tertiary kind of creator.
Playmaker, yeah.
I thought he had flashes, though, today, particularly in the first quarter, I thought. On a large scale, didn't look comfortable, but there was a couple moments there. He had a nice lob into Whiteside from, you know, a side pick-and-roll area. He had a couple of moments. I think he had a dribble drive where he ended up creating a three-pointer for Tyler Johnson. I can't remember when it happened in the game, but that was really nice. So he just had a couple of flashes there. But like you were saying with Goran Dragic, him being out tonight, you know, it's been the story of the season. If Dragic is out, every time he's been out, the Heat just come apart at the seams here. But you have an interesting theory about why you think that he was resting tonight.
Well, I think, you know, with Dragic facing a matchup against Westbrook, arguably the most dominant point guard in the league today, I think it enhances his trade value to be sitting out so that he doesn't get visibly burnt on the defensive end. You know, Dragic isn't necessarily a strong defender, and Westbrook was going to make him bad. So if you're going to be shopping Dragic potentially to a Western Conference playoff contender, even an Eastern Conference contender, you don't want to show his weaknesses on a national scale like that. So there might be a reason behind it, and they might have sat him out on purpose. Now, he was listed out due to back spasms, but I don't think he's missed any time beforehand. We didn't really get any kind of indication that he was sitting out tonight's game. So maybe there's something to it. Maybe there isn't. I mean, that's just my theory. I think it's a plausible one. We've seen, you know, guys sitting out throughout the season that inexplicably miss a game here and there. If you want to look at it on a bigger conspiracy theory, maybe it's part of a season-long tanking process. But, you know, specifically as far as Dragic sitting out, if he got exposed against, you know, Westbrook the way he was likely to do, it certainly, you know, behooves Miami, if you're looking to shop him later on, to increase his trade value and not show him being necessarily a weak defender.
Well, that's a good a spot as any to jump into our mailbag here. So we've put off this mailbag. It's not Mailbag Monday. It's not Transmissions Tuesday, but it's We Answer Your Questions Wednesday. I don't know.
Nice. Good save. I was thinking something along the same lines.
All right. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to answer your questions. So speaking of Goran Dragic, Yusuf, I'm going to butcher this, Yusuf Kigundu? Sorry, sure. If I screwed that up. He gave us a few scenarios, but I'm going to simplify the question just for the purpose of this audio. Zach Lowe reported that the Timberwolves could be a trade destination for Goran Dragic. What would a trade look like? And Yusuf provided a few different snapshots of his great ESPN trade machine work. Things centered around Chris Dunn, maybe Zach LaVine. I wanted to throw it to you first, David. What do you think?
I think if they're looking to acquire a guy like Dragic, I think it would be because they're looking to move Rubio, who is their, you know, obviously Minnesota starting point guard. He's a strong defender, flashy passer, a poor shooter, and maybe doesn't necessarily fit as far as being the kind of playmaker they want. And you could argue that maybe Tibbs, you know, Coach Tom Thibodeau over in Minnesota might be looking for somebody who's more of a scoring oriented guard. But to be honest with you, I'm not sure that works for them. The Timberwolves have been discussed a lot, as most teams that are struggling are at this time of year, as far as potential trade scenarios. But I think Rubio does fit with what they're looking for. I think, you know, you've got Zach LaVine, who's a very high scoring two guard. You know, he's got 3-point range. He can cut to the rim. Obviously, he can finish at a high rate. Karl Anthony Towns clearly is a very good player there. So to me, I don't know that you'd want to move a guy like Rubio, who is a good playmaker and can create offensive options for your other two big scoring names there. Now, it'd be great to have a third scorer there. They don't really have that. So maybe that's where he fits in there. But I'm not sure if he's necessarily a good fit in Minnesota either. But did you have any options or any kind of potential scenarios that you think a trade to the Minnesota would look like?
Well, first, I'm with you. Lowe is reporting this for a reason, right? He thinks that it's a landing spot that makes sense. Maybe there's been some rumblings. Maybe there's been some backroom discussions. I don't know. But I'm with you. It seems weird. Dragic is a score-first point guard. He's a good facilitator, but he's not necessarily a great passer. Not nearly sure where Rubio is, as far as Rubio's not just flashy, but he's got great court vision. He's smart. He's a smart passer. And Dragic, I don't think, is to that level as a passer. He does seem to need the ball in his hands. And that, I don't know, maybe Andrew Wiggins gets the ball in his hand fewer in isolation positions and develops a Wade-like, you know, cutting to the basket type game. LaVine becomes a you know, a Klay Thompson-like 3 and D slasher post-up, you know, oversized shooting guard post-up kind of threat. I don't know. But so maybe it works, but I don't want to talk the Timberwolves out of it because I think that he needs as many options as they can use. So,
you know, I'm curious now that you mention it now, you know, I'm thinking if they're looking to sacrifice Wiggins' scoring and the knock on Wiggins, as you've probably seen, as most of our listeners have probably seen in recent weeks, is that he just doesn't do anything else particularly well. And so if you're looking at the fact that he's, you know, they're small forward there and he's a good scorer, but you can parlay Rubio's lack of scoring into Dragic's, maybe you're willing to part with Wiggins' scoring for somebody who does do everything but score well, and that's another small forward that there is in Miami, Justice Winslow. So maybe a Dragic and Winslow trade for Rubio and Wiggins might work.
That might be good, but I'm not sure that the Timberwolves are willing to sell Wiggins for Dragic and Winslow. I don't know. I feel like a lot of what they do is based around Wiggins, and they're still not sure what's there. And that, but that's like a blockbuster big swing trade.
It is.
I think for the Heat, if the Wolves are a real trade partner, the question is, what do they think about Chris Dunn, the rookie point guard they drafted out of Providence this year? Or what do they think about Tyus Jones, another young point guard that they have who basically has been buried on the depth chart, but is a nice player. He's a good passer. Mm-hmm. There's some scoring potential there. Relatively athletic. So if they liked Chris Dunn in whatever scouting that they did this year, if they feel like Chris Dunn could be their future point guard and they can get him back, because if the Wolves get Goran Dragic, I mean, that's their point guard. They don't need Chris Dunn. They don't need Tyus Jones. I don't think that the Heat would take Rubio back because the contracts are too similar and he's locked in for 3 years. So I think either Rubio would end up riding the bench for the Timberwolves, and that would just be the cost of that trade, but and getting a better starter in that place, or there would be a third team involved, which we don't need to get into. You listeners, you do that on your own trade machine playtime, where there's a third team involved that takes Rubio. I don't know who that is, but maybe getting Chris Dunn or Tyus Jones, and then another player like, I don't know, a Cole Aldrich back in return to start making the salaries work because those other guys are on rookie scale deals. Maybe something like that, or Nikola Pekovic, who is on a, got 2 more years left. I don't know if they'd be willing to do that in order to get like a good player in return. I don't know, but I'm not sure what that trade looks like.
Yeah, it seems unlikely. I mean, I know the scuttlebutt is that Thibodeau is looking for a veteran presence, particularly defensively, somebody who can kind of bring the team together. Not necessarily somebody as a to fill a leadership role, but maybe just kind of do lots of little things there and work together, show a strong commitment to the Tibbs offense and defensive, you know, teachings and things of this sort. You know, they're still very young there. But I think it's just the reality is for somebody who doesn't cover Minnesota as much as others, I think, you know, the expectations might have been a little unrealistic to start the season. A lot of people thought they were a legitimate playoff contender, if not a title contender. Some people believe that. That was probably not going to ever work out, but I think they've just stumbled. And they did have a lot of they have a lot of youth there, and unfortunately they just haven't coalesced in the same way a lot of people expected them to.
All right, I'm going to be really irresponsible and reckless. You ready for this?
Yes, always.
While you were talking, and I promise I was listening, there is – I worked up a three-team trade on the trade machine, and this is why it's very responsible. All right, the Heat get Rajon Rondo and Chris Dunn.
Oh, God.
Rajon Rondo is on essentially – he's essentially an expiring contract here because he's only got $3 million guaranteed next season. So that $3 million can become a fee to get rid of him after the year.
Okay.
So the Heat get Rondo, Chris Dunn, and Sacramento's top 10 protected pick this year.
Okay.
Minnesota gets Goran Dragic and Taj Gibson.
Oh, okay.
Taj Gibson, you know, back with Tom Thibodeau. And the Bulls get Ricky Rubio, a nice point guard, a defensive first point guard who doesn't necessarily need the ball, who can defend the best guard on the other side of the floor, letting Dwayne Wade and Jimmy Butler create. Basically what they wanted out of Rondo, but Rondo's not good, and Rubio is. So,
and Sacramento would get nothing?
No, the Bulls have Sacramento's pick. They have that pick.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Okay.
Yeah, I should have explained
that. Up trade. Yeah. No, my bad.
So Chicago – well, I don't expect you to know all the real GM.
I do. I expect myself to know all these.
You hold yourself to a high standard. So yeah, the Bulls have Sacramento's top 10 protected pick, so they convey that over to Miami. And that could come Miami's way if, in this hypothetical situation, because Sacramento, don't look now, but they're in the running for the 8th seed. I think if the playoffs started today, they would be the 8th seed in the West. So, just a deal. All right, let's move on. Kind of keeping up with this Goran Dragic theme here. Theodore Stevens asks, okay, how about this potential trade? The Heat get Mario Hezonja and Nikola Vucevic, the Magic at Goran Dragic. What do you think?
I don't think it's likely to happen. I know that they're ready to move on from Hezonja. He hasn't gotten much playing time. There were some discussions a couple of weeks ago about possibly sending him down to the D League because he's a guy who definitely needs to get some work. He's just the kind of the arrogance and confidence that a lot of people heard about him prior to him being drafted last season has not manifested. When he does get playing time, he's looked very timid. He hasn't felt very comfortable, and the scoring punch just hasn't been there. So I know that they've talked about shipping him down there, and a lot of people have rumored that he might be on his way out. Now, as far as Vucevic is concerned, he does make a lot of money, not necessarily a huge amount, in today's market. He's a high-scoring center who rebounds well, shoots well, is a great passer for the big man position. He's not a strong defender, at least he historically hasn't been, but he's been a lot better this year than he has in the past in his short career. So I think given the fact that they have Serge Ibaka there, who they might lose in free agency this summer, and Bismack Biyombo on a long-term contract, I think if they're willing to move a center, it would probably be Biyombo. I think they're looking to move on from that because as much as he provides defensively, he doesn't do much else. He's definitely not a scorer. He's not a passer. He doesn't do anything else but defend and protect the rim at a high level. But he's making so much money, they'd probably be more than willing. If Vucevic is able to keep up his defensive tenacity that we've seen this season, they might be willing to insert him back in the starting lineup. At this point, they're using him kind of the way Oklahoma City did with Enes Kanter, bringing Vucevic off the bench and having him be a high-scoring big man.
Well, maybe that's what the Heat would like. I mean, Vucevic and Hassan Whiteside, with Whiteside playing the Steven Adams role, defensive first guy who can roll to the rim. Maybe it works.
Don't get me wrong.
Do this.
From Miami's perspective, I think it's a great move in that you got a young guy in Hezonja who definitely has potential and just hasn't been able to realize it in Orlando. I think Scott Skiles messed him up his first season, kind of yanked him around a lot and didn't really give him an opportunity to shine. I think it hasn't helped to get a guy like, a Frank Vogel in there, who's obviously a defensive first kind of coach. So it hasn't helped him to go through this transition.
I think the Magic would be willing to part with Vucevic for the right deal. They just signed Biyombo. As you said, Frank Vogel's a defensive first guy. Biyombo is the better defender. And if Frank Vogel and the Magic come to the realization like, oh my gosh, wait, Aaron Gordon is better as a stretch four, then all of a sudden you have Biyombo in there as the rim protector, and then you move Aaron Gordon to the four position, all of a sudden you have a lot more space there. Vucevic kind of mucks things up a little bit because you can't have Vucevic at center with a stretch four like Aaron Gordon that just leaves you too vulnerable defensively. But having a Biyombo type there who can just basically defend the rim while the other four guys do everything else on offense, that could work maybe. I don't know. And Biyombo has shown in a spaced out scheme like there was in Toronto to be an effective rim runner. And maybe they can do that and you get a real point guard in there like Goran Dragic, and maybe he's able to unlock some of those fun things. But
now a couple of things in that scenario. What do you do with Serge Ibaka? Do you continue starting him over Gordon?
Yeah.
And have Gordon off the bench?
I think that's what you do. If you're the Magic, and then you just kind of maybe let him walk after this year. Sorry, buddy. Maybe try to trade him.
No, it makes sense.
Maybe try to trade him in another deal. But that's the Magic's problem. I don't care about them.
And then secondly, though, as far as Orlando is concerned, Elfrid Payton supposedly was a major sticking point for the front office. They saw him as the future of the team. They thought he was a major piece moving forward. And allegedly, this was a major reason why Scott Skiles resigned during the offseason, is that he disagreed with the front office regarding Payton's role. He's coming off the bench now with DJ Augustin actually starting. So it's a little surprising that they've made that adjustment, but I'm not sure. Maybe
they're with him.
DJ Augustin? or Elfrid Payton.
Elfrid Payton, is that where you're going?
I don't think so. I don't think they're willing to part with him. I think they like him coming off the bench.
Let's just say they are, though. And they call Pat Riley and they say, okay, we'll give you Vucevic and your pick, Hezonja or Elfrid Payton.
I think Miami should take Hezonja.
But they'd probably take Payton.
But they'd probably take Payton because he's a better defender, and I think they could think that he might develop.
Dragic. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but either way, it's an interesting situation because they have a few of these young guys. Maybe they don't like Aaron Gordon, and they're willing to do that. Even though I think Aaron Gordon and Winslow on the same floor would be spacing suicide. But
oh yeah, now I did talk to Gordon last week, and I asked him about it because he's been yanked around, and he seemed a little like upset about the lack of communication. And he didn't say it in so many words, but I asked him about the difficulty of trying to come off the bench or, you know, when you're starting, and he tried to, you know, make it seem like there were positives to either role. And when I asked him about the communication, he's like, oh, my job is just to go out there and play. I'm like, well, have they mentioned anything? He's like, no, not really. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's frustration on his end. He hasn't expressed anything. And I mean, I think that we all see, I mean, outside of Orlando, everybody sees that Gordon is better equipped to handle the power forward position, but Vogel is convinced they could turn him into a playmaking three the way Paul George was, and that doesn't seem to be the case.
Yeah, it's a mess in Orlando. They don't know what they're doing, but doing a 2-for-1 or a 3-for-1 deal like this would be makes sense, whether it's with the Heat for Dragic or not.
Right.
It does seem like that's what could maybe unclog this roster, and in trading something for a backcourt score that they might be looking for, it does make sense for them. And for the Heat, it's a deal that sort of makes sense. I mean, Vucevic and Whiteside are a little redundant, but if you'd rather just, there's a situation where you put Vucevic at power forward and you just double down on size with this Twin Towers thing and say, you know what, let's just be really good at this thing. Right. And they, Vucevic and Whiteside have enough touch shooting, Vucevic more so than Whiteside, that might be able to work in a weird way. I don't know. The Whiteside.
I like Vucevic's passing. I mean, they spot him up in the high post a lot, and he can create some offense there. I mean, I wonder if it would work in that sense.
It would be very Memphis Grizzlies grit and grind, where your two big men have like really high usage rates.
Right.
And maybe whoever ends up being the point guard there, whether it's Tyler Johnson or Josh Richardson or Elfrid Payton or whoever, whatever, ends up maybe taking a step back in comparison to what Goran Dragic is doing with the team.
All right.
So, all right, let's move on to, let's see, which question should we do next? Let's stick with the trading theme here.
Hmm.
You know what? No, let's come back to that. Let's go to this question. I'm going to switch it up here. This is from at Justin Shock on Twitter. What's more frustrating, tanking or failing to tank by winning games? What's more frustrating? I don't know.
To me, I think it's the latter. I mean,
failing to tank.
Yeah. If you're going to tank, at least you have a clear identity or a clear agenda in mind. You look like you're going to try and throw as many games as possible. You're going to continue to develop young players, throw them out there and have them kind of, you know, go through the, get forged by the fire and then see what you have and kind of test their mettle a little bit. And that's metal, M-E-T-T-L-E, not M-E-T-A-L. But at the same time, you want to figure out who you've got. And you know, that's a way of doing so. Even if you wind up losing games in the short term, it helps you in the long run. And again, either establishing that they're viable players that you can build on or looking to move them for other players that you can continue to develop or build on. So to me, I think tanking at least has a purpose. Failing to tank, you know, you're in this quasi pseudo, you know, you're not quite sure where you are because right. It's, you know, are you losing games on purpose or do you just suck? I mean, are you not doing a very good job of tanking? And you know, that's Miami's MO, is that they you know, even Riley said that they're rebuilding, but he doesn't like using that word. So he kind of shies away. He hedges himself considerably whenever he talks about a rebuilding effort. So it's hard to kind of pin down. So to me, I think that's more frustrating, is that you're never quite sure. You know, at the start of the season, again, you know, knowing that Bosch was, going to be missing some games, I think there was still hope that you might be able to compete and you might get some of these veteran guys on short-term deals and kind of turn them around and make them into a viable playoff contender, even though that's not going to really help this team much in the long run. But now all of a sudden you got guys missing a bunch of games. You're not really winning. You're not coalescing. It's difficult to handle. And I think that's the more frustrating part.
I'm going to basically say what you said, but I'm going to say it differently in that.
All right.
If you're tanking, at least you know what you're doing. And right. If you're doing it, you're succeeding. If you're failing to tank by winning games, you're not successful. Right? So, sure. You know, you're trying to do something and you're not doing it. And so you're not successful. So that's why that would be more frustrating. I agree with everything. And this right now, this is a little frustrating just because, you know, we don't know what the Heat's goal is. Are they rebuilding? Are they not rebuilding? Why Riley says he is, and then all of a sudden he says, if we do rebuild, it's going to be quick. So now you're like, okay, they're not going to trade Dragic and Whiteside. They're still going right. to keep trying to do the same thing that they've been failing at over the last 3 years, trying to recruit one more big free agent. So we don't really know what the plan is, mm-hmm. and that's why I think people do look at – there are people that want tanking because at least they know what the plan is, and that's what happened in Philadelphia. Or you look at tanking to a different degree like the Celtics are doing, where you get a bunch of young assets and maybe you play a very fun style of basketball with a bunch of young players, and maybe you overplay your expectations, exceed expectations, and you get lucky, and that's a little bit of fun. Right now, the Heat are just kind of like, all right, we got a 30-year-old point guard who's going to be 31, a 27-year-old center who may or may not be able to be the anchor of a team, and a bunch of misfit players, and we don't know what's going on, and one-year deals, so we don't know what's going on. So right now, this is frustrating, but kind of what you were saying before with the whole situation with Dwayne Wade leaving when you weren't expecting him to, probably, maybe, I don't know, Chris Bosh and his whole situation, the Heat weren't prepared for any of this, really. So maybe by the trade deadline, they're able to turn this into a plan, and maybe that's just what it's going to take. So, all right, a couple more questions. This is from Douglas Philip Yee. This week's ESPN power rankings say opponents average less points per 100 possessions when Whiteside sits, and more when he's on the floor, basically saying that the defense is better when Whiteside is off the court than when he's on the court. This is a very similar to a phenomenon we saw last season. How is that possible, and is it a concern? That's the question. I do think that, if you don't mind, I'm going to go first on this one.
No, go for it.
Because I've been kind of itching to do this. So, I think that these stats are sort of bullshit, to be honest. I mean, Whiteside plays with the starters. He comes off the floor basically when the other team's backups come in, and that I think has a lot to do with it. It's just White and the Heat's team, you know, their poor team effort in these first quarters and in the start of games. That just goes against his plus minuses and his PERs and his points per 100 possessions and all these counting stats. It goes all against that stuff. Defense is so hard to value statistically and to quantify that way. That really is the eye test. Now, does Whiteside screw up defensively all the time? Sure. Does he chase blocks? Yeah, to the degree they did last year. I don't think so. But it's hard to prove any of that. It's not a concern to me, no. I mean, look at somebody like Kawhi Leonard right now, and he's got horrible defensive ratings. And this has kind of been an ongoing joke in NBA writers and bloggers, Twitter spheres and stuff like that, that he's got like one of the worst – he's got only the only person with a worse defensive rating than him on the Spurs is Pau Gasol, a notoriously poor defender. So I just don't value any of this stuff.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Kawhi, because that's a perfect example of why these statistics can't always be taken, at face value. And you know, there was an excellent piece on CBS Sports a few weeks ago that everybody should read if they haven't, by a friend of the program, Matt Moore, who talked about his theory of Kawhi-solation. I don't know if you got a chance to read it.
Yes.
Okay. And he showed exactly what the problem is that opponents have figured out that Kawhi Leonard isn't a poor defender at all, obviously, that he's so good defensively that what they're doing is they know he's going to key in on an opposing team's best score. So they've been positioning that good score. He used Chicago as a prime example, in this case, Jimmy Butler. So they position Jimmy Butler in the far corner and then slide the rest of the team over to the opposing end of the court, where they have four other Bulls players facing the other four Spurs defenders, all of which are negative defenders. And so you'll be able to score at will with Kawhi basically taken out of consideration. He's basically focusing on keeping Butler from scoring. Butler's numbers take a bit of a hit in this particular game, but at the same token, you get guys like Rajon Rondo or Dwayne Wade or Robin Lopez or Taj Gibson, all of which can score at a pretty high level going up against negative defenders like Pau Gasol or Tony Parker. So, you know, it really makes sense the way to shift that kind of offense to put pressure on a defense. So to me, I don't think anybody's necessarily doing that against Miami, not to that same extent. But I think to your point, the numbers don't necessarily indicate the full story. And I think that's part of the big reason is what you mentioned before, that the fact that you've got a lot of second string players going up against, you know, better maybe defenders than James Johnson and Tyler Johnson's guys who are more engaged. Like, let's say James Johnson is probably a better defender than either Derek Williams or Josh McRoberts, who's starting at the power forward position. Tyler right. Johnson, when he comes in at point guard, is a better defender than Goran Dragic. So you have better individual defenders going up against weaker scorers in the second team. And that's why those numbers are reflect that Whiteside's, per 100 possessions, are a lot higher than they ought to be. But I don't think it has anything to do with this individual rim protection or defense, which I think is still at an elite level.
Absolutely. And the Heat and Whiteside is very important to what the Heat do defensively, in that right. they funnel everything to him. So he's right. got a lot on his plate defensively every game. The Heat want to give up as few three-pointers as possible, so they run everybody off the line, funnel guys to Whiteside. They don't do that with Willie Reed or even James Johnson when he's at center during small right. ball situations. They really do overload Whiteside with guys cutting to the rim and stuff like that, and we see it all the time.
Now, I would point out that if there is a statistic that does condemn his defense a little bit, it's probably that I think opponents are shooting a higher field goal percentage when guarded by Whiteside than when they aren't facing him, which I think is a bigger concern. I think that's what the numbers indicated earlier in the season. I haven't checked them lately, but I think right. that's still the case.
He does struggle coming up and playing jump shots and stuff like that.
Right. As opposed to a guy like Rudy Gobert, who I think people are shooting somewhere in the low 40s against him, as opposed to what they normally shoot around the painted area. He's probably the better individual defender at this yeah. point. You know, his numbers aren't necessarily as high as Whiteside's, but I think he's certainly considered a better defender.
So this is our last question, and it has something to do with Whiteside. Mm. Given everything we were talking about and what we see from his son Whiteside, Huffman 2K15 asks, what's the value and trade market for his son Whiteside? Interesting question.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's still fairly high. I think his contract is a fairly onerous one. You know, it's a long-term deal. He's getting paid quite a bit of money. And I think this season has shown that he's not necessarily the kind of superstar level player that you can build a team around. But as we've discussed on other podcasts, he's certainly a guy that is a complementary piece of a title contending team. If you're lacking an adequate rim protector, if you need a guy who can get a large number of rebounds, who can score at a higher percentage around the rim, if you have a team of perimeter-based shooters that take some of the pressure off of him to score as much as he has to here in Miami, I think he could be much more efficient than he's been this season. So I think there's still quite a bit of value for a guy like him, even if it's somewhat reduced in that he's not necessarily a guy you can build around. I think there's still quite a bit for him. And if anything, though, that contract probably makes it a little difficult for him to move. There aren't many teams that can assimilate a $20 million deal like his.
Jonathan Sharks at The Ringer actually wrote something about this last week, where there is almost a glut of true centers and big men in the NBA right now. And you look at a team like the Philadelphia 76ers with Nerlens Noel and Jahlil Okafor and Joel Embiid. That's too many. They have too many centers on one team, and it looks like they're going to trade one of them, probably Nerlens Noel or Okafor. You look at a team like the Dallas Mavericks, who might tank, but they have a one-year contract with Andrew Bogut, who a lot of teams could probably use if you're a playoff contender and want a rim protector who could pass the ball pretty well like Bogut. They might want to move him for a late first-round or early second-round pick. And then, the Denver Nuggets with Joseph Nurkic and Nikola Jokic. They have a couple of guys there that don't work together, and even you can throw Kenneth Faried in there too, because he's played a little bit of small ball center. There's a lot of centers who might be available. That said, the Heat's advantage here is that Whiteside's better than any of those guys. And that could go a long way as far as his trade value goes, because if somebody's going to be looking to acquire a center the first team they might call is Miami about Hassan Whiteside. So I think the Heat could probably get a lot of value in return for Whiteside, depending on the team. You look at a team like, I don't know, I use this team a lot, but Portland, who really, Whiteside would be a quick fix for all of their issues. Rebounding, rim protection, I mean, it solves a lot of their problems. An outlet for Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum on pick and rolls, I mean, it solves a lot of their issues. Maybe Washington, maybe Charlotte. There's a couple of teams that could use a player like Whiteside. I think his value is still pretty high. I don't know that you're going to get a star back in return. Like, Whiteside for John Wall doesn't work. I don't think the Wizards would do that. I think they'd hesitate even on Whiteside for Bradley Beal. Just because of the value, generally, of three-point shooting compared to the availability of big men. Like, they could go out and get Nerlens Noel instead and not have to give up Bradley Beal. And that's going to be a lot of the math going into this at the deadline. It's going to be a bunch of teams that need big men are going to be making phone calls, and they're going to say, okay, what do you want for Whiteside? And this is all hypothetical, but what do you want for Whiteside? Okay, great. If they can get Nerlens Noel, who might be, what, 30, 40% of Whiteside for 20% of the price?
Right.
That's math that makes sense for that team. So that's going to be Miami's issue. So maybe now the Heat have to come down on their asking price. So all in all, basically, suffice to say that his value is high in a vacuum, but it really depends on what happens in this trade market. Maybe the Sixers are willing to part with one of their centers sooner rather than later. And now all of a sudden, it's one option off the table, and Whiteside's value grows after that. I don't know, but
now I know this wasn't a question that was pitched in our mailbag here, but given the interest in the trade possibilities for Miami this season, do you expect the trade deadline to be a busy one, not just for Miami, but across the league? And I wonder, because it seems like maybe a lot more teams are interested in making a move here and there that might vault them into playoff contention. And I think in a case like, you know, for Miami fans and our listeners, they're looking at acquiring, either moving Dragic in the hopes that maybe you can get a draft pick the way that Riley wants, or maybe a young player who fits more along the mold of the other young players that you're trying to build around. But I mean, we're all looking at trade possibilities because it's fun and it's interesting, and it's certainly worth talking about in you know, the late December. But given the fact that it's likely to be Cleveland and Golden State competing for a championship, is it realistic to expect anybody's going to make a move knowing that these two teams are likely to come up with a championship?
I think it's going to be pretty busy, but I think it's going to be busy on like the 1st of January. I think it's going to be a little bit earlier because there's teams that have a lot of incentive to make a move earlier than February.
Okay.
And maybe like after the holiday season ends and all these guys are done spending time with their families and really kind of thinking things through and whatever, making New Year's resolutions, whatever, I want to tank this year, I want to make the playoffs this year, then come the 1st of January, teams might be making moves. Because you look at a team like the Sacramento Kings, or the Chicago Bulls, the Washington Wizards, the Orlando Magic, the Indiana Pacers, all teams that ownership has basically come down and said, you're making the playoffs this year, or heads will roll. Teams with like real incentive to make the playoffs. And then you have teams that have real incentive to tank, the Miami Heat, the Dallas Mavericks. There are plenty of teams that have good reason to tank. And those are all teams that could do, you know, that could work together to achieve their goals. And for the Heat, it makes sense. I'd probably bet this point, I'd put my money on one of Whiteside or Dragic being traded by February. I think that's more likely. And I don't want to see Dragic go necessarily because I think he's a really good player. And one who, like we saw tonight in that Thunder game, when he's on the floor, he really helps out what's going on with Winslow and Richardson and Tyler Johnson, and just kind of helps keep them in their lanes and develop. But the value of that over, say, getting a top 15 pick or a young player in return, I think Kevin O'Connor at The Ringer wrote about a possible deal with the Bulls and the Heat, and Rondo going to the Heat for Goran Dragic.
Ooh.
And it would be like, it would be a lot. That's kind of where I got my trade earlier in the podcast from, is I think he said something about Rondo, a young player, and the Kings protected top 10 protected pick in return for Dragic. And to me, that makes a lot of sense if you're the Heat. You get Rondo, sure. So you have a backfill at that point guard position, a true point guard who can distribute and dominate the ball and keep it out of young guys' hands and just let them efficiently develop. That makes sense. Somebody who had success with Boogie Cousins. So maybe he has a little bit of success with Hassan Whiteside in pick-and-roll situations. Maybe they can do something. I don't know. But more so, you're getting a young player like a Bobby Portis, who's a stretch four, who could fit in nicely with what the Heat need. And obviously a draft pick that could convey either this year or next year. So, I don't know. That makes sense to me. There's a lot of rumblings going on, so I put my money on something happening. Where there's kind of where there's smoke, there's fire. I'm kind of betting on that.
Speaking of smoke and fire, Phil Jackson has just tweeted out that he's ended his engagement with Lakers executive Jeannie Buss. Are we breaking news here? I don't know.
I think we just did. What does that mean?
Jeannie Buss, you know, they were in a long-term relationship. Yeah. They were allegedly engaged for years, and they've I'll read the full statement from Phil. With mutual love and respect, we have decided to end our engagement. With the nature of our professional obligations and the geographic distance between us, sustaining the relationship has been difficult. We have shared many wonderful moments through the years, and we expect to remain supportive of each other in the future.
I just stop. I don't even care.
Well, that's it. That's the entire
thing. Oh, that's it. Okay, good. This is ridiculous. So, yeah, long-term relationships suck. That's basically what he said.
Long-distance
relationships. Sorry. So, not a Freudian slip, I promise. Girlfriend, if you're listening, we're cool. But I wonder if Phil Jackson is. I wonder if Jeannie Buss knows about this, or if she just read that tweet and was like, "Oh, okay."
No, it's mutually signed by both of them, initialed by PJ/JB. So she's aware.
Is this on official New York Knicks parchment?
It's on Phil's Twitter. I mean, what a bizarre way to break up. It's not quite, you know, Pat Riley resigning via fax or what was it? God, what's his the drummer? I can't remember his name now. Phil Collins, who got divorced, you remember, via fax?
No, I've never heard this story.
What? Yeah, he faxed his ex-wife divorce papers.
Oh, wow.
That's cold-blooded, but yeah.
Yeah.
Twitter, that's the new way to break up, I guess. I don't know. I've never heard that one before, but I guess it's the wave of the future.
That's so strange that he would tweet about it. I guess, I mean, it makes sense. You want to get ahead of the story, and he's just like, this is not a big deal, so now nobody's going to talk about it. So I guess it's actually very smart by him. But it's also kind of weird that we care. Like, it has no basketball influence, right? Yeah, I mean, now nice. any like, whatever dumb rumors there were about Phil Jackson going back to the Lakers is dead.
I guess that's
all there is, but no, everybody knew that wasn't going to happen anyway, so. All right. Well.
What a good way to end our podcast.
Yeah, yeah. So this is our last podcast of the year, barring anything crazy. If the Heat do some sort of crazy trade between now and next week, I guess we'll try to hop back on and talk about it, but I don't think that's going to happen. So just to all the listeners, Happy New Year. Thank you for sticking with us for, well, it's been almost half the year that we've been doing Locked On Heat before we were the Heat Check. And of course, we appreciate all the listeners who came from the Heat Check and continue to listen to us, and all of our new listeners that we've had plenty of while we've been here. And Happy New Year to our boss, David Locke, who brought us on here. And we're appreciative of the opportunity. And we look forward to next year and continuing this great and terrific Miami Heat season and talking about it on this podcast, right?
Absolutely. And thanks to all of our listeners who wrote in for today's mailbag. I know it's a little bit late, but we still always want to hear from you. So please continue to contact us either via Twitter or via email. We want to hear from you. We want to continue to take your questions, not just about trades, but anything that you notice about the ongoings of this particular season, whether or not you have any kind of theories that you want us to discuss or break down. We are always happy to hear from you. So thank you so much.
But since none of you guys got us Christmas presents, just we'll be okay if you just subscribe to the show and just tell one friend that you have to subscribe to the show. That's all we ask. And that'll make up for not getting us anything. So, all right. Happy New Year to you, David.
Likewise, Wes. All right. Looking forward to talking to you next year.
We'll catch you next time.